And you're very welcome back to the STEM Inspirations podcast, brought to you by the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. John Loftus bringing you another episode from Valentia Island in Kerry. Now, if you listen to the last episode with Micheál Lynn, you'll have gotten a great insight on the history behind Valentia Island itself and its role in the world of telecommunications. And every year, the Transatlantic Cable Foundation celebrate the historic achievement of the first successful transatlantic cable by hosting a festival and a lecture series in the station itself. And one of the guest speakers was BT's own Nicola Millard. Now, Nicola has a very interesting job. She was formerly a futurologist, as you will hear. Now, one thing that Nicola does is looks at all the ways organizations can be more efficient in looking after their customers and looking after their people too. And her lecture is very, very interesting and points the way to maybe what the way the world of work may look like in the future. So I think you'll find it very engaging. So sit back and listen to Dr. Nicola Millard at the Transatlantic Cable Foundation Lecture 2023.
Thank you for inviting me to this fabulous place. We had the tour this morning. It's just so gorgeous. I think I'm going to move here. So, thank you very much. So, hello, my name's Nicola. I did used to be BT's futurologist. And before you ask, yes, that is a very silly job title. And the reason I used to have a love-hate relationship with it was I always used to get asked the same question, which I can feel emanating towards me now, which is, do you have a crystal ball? The answer to that question is, yes, I do. I saw no future in it, though. Although my job title has got a little bit more boring, so I am a principal innovation partner with BT, my job most definitely is not boring. So I actually am normally based in the east of England. So I'm normally based in the east of England in a lovely place called Adastral Park. For those of you in the telecoms world, it's also been variously known as Martlesham Heath, Martlesham BT Laboratories. It's basically BT's main research and innovation center. It's actually a historic site. And if we look at the history, which we have been of this fabulous place today, you can trace our history back to Bletchley Park and the code breakers via Dollis Hill, which was our second site, and Adastral Park we acquired back in the 60s from the Royal Air Force. And it was the Royal Air Force's research and innovation site. So I keep saying they used to crash planes. We crash technologies. So it's a fabulous place. And to be honest, one of the reasons why I don't need the crystal ball, because I can literally walk down a corridor and bump into somebody who is a world expert in quantum computing or artificial intelligence. And I can ask them lots of very dumb questions, because I always say I'm a slightly unusual part of our innovation team. I'm half a technologist, so I'm never terribly sure whether it's the boring bottom half or the top half. Well, I think I'm a bit Christmassy today, but I'm not sure which half is the technologist, but the other half is a psychologist. So I always claim I look at the most disruptive part of innovation, which is, of course, not the technology, it's us, because unless we embrace it and use it, it's pretty useless. So my role is to try and understand all sorts of things around behaviors, behavior change, culture change. I do research on the future of work and also customer experience. So I'm going to talk mainly about the future of work today. So I'm going to take you on a bit of a journey from automation to Zadonks. I will explain what a Zadonk is. I've already had a few of those questions today as well, as we go along, although truthfully it's more Zadonks to automation. I'll do it backwards, but I always say my relationship with the future of work started at my very beginning of my career. One of my first jobs in BT back in 1992, which dates me, although I always claim I was only six at the time, was that we trialed home working very, very early on. I think we were one of the first companies in Europe to try it. Back in 1992, it was a technology trial primarily. We did it up in Inverness. It was an experiment. So we fondly called it the Inverness experiment. But as you can see, we put in some fabulous technologies, including video conferencing, which you'll see up there. That's a video conferencing unit at the time. It did look a little bit like a small refrigerator. And to be honest, the quality was terrible as well. So it wasn't actually used an awful lot. But we kind of overspecified quite a lot, as we frequently do, because we wanted it to work. We wanted to prove the technology. I was a very small cog in the machine looking at the psychology and well-being of this, because people hadn't worked from home. We worked them from home for a whole year. They were volunteers as well. That's the difference between this trial and what we've just gone through, by the way. So they wanted to do this. And to be honest, we got some fabulous results at the end of the year. They didn't, as we maybe were anxious, to go slightly mad working from home. In fact, they learned to cook and learned who their neighbours are, something that actually a lot of us did during lockdowns as well. The problem, of course, was although we had a lot of technologies in the ground, and indeed a transatlantic cable that would enable us to talk to people wherever we happened to be, the technology at the time wasn't quite there. We didn't have the holy trinity of technologies that got us through the pandemic, namely, of course, connectivity, collaboration tools, and the cloud. And to be honest, if we'd had a pandemic in 1992, we would have probably really struggled. And actually, I was in Ireland. I was in Dublin the day before everything shut down, before lockdowns. And it was a scramble where people were running around trying to find laptops and all sorts of things, because although home working is nothing new, it hadn't necessarily been embraced a lot at the time. So I think, certainly looking at the future world of work, one of the questions is, well, what is the future going to look like? To be honest, I always love to look at past predictions. And of course, one of the best in terms of futurology was Arthur C. Clarke, who obviously was, again, looking at the forefront of communication technologies. And this was an interview he did with the BBC, actually, saying that in the future, we can work from anywhere. Tahiti, Bali, Valentia Island. In my case, Ipswich, very similar to Tahiti and Bali, I have to say. So of course, you know, we've solved it. We can work from absolutely anywhere. That's the end of my talk. Because human nature is such that although we have these incredible technologies, often it's culture that anchors us back. And as I said, home working and remote working and hybrid working had been around before the pandemic, but a crisis is an incredible, a bullet train for innovation. And boy, did we have a crisis. It's quite interesting to see the shifts that we saw during the pandemic. And obviously these shifts were slightly different to what we were doing in the 1990s, in that a lot of the people that were working from home did not have a choice. Although we were, of course, also lucky if we could work from home. And just, you know, reflecting on some of the figures pre-pandemic, during pandemic, and well, we're not quite actually out of it yet. The World Health Organization has not said, hey, it's not a pandemic anymore. So we're still living with it. But we can see that shock to the system accelerated a lot of these trends. So if we just compare, I mean, the US, obviously home working wasn't that popular before the pandemic. You can see the massive spike that we suddenly saw when the pandemic hit and lockdowns hit. And it hasn't gone right back down to normal. So in actual fact, a 500% increase in work from home in the US. Actually, Canada has just topped the world listings of people that are working in a hybrid and remote way. So North America per se is working in very, very different ways, as is, of course, the UK. Ireland actually has also experienced a massive transition as well. I dug out some of the CSO stats. There were some very interesting CSO stats around Ireland and how that had accelerated the move towards hybrid and remote working, to the extent that actually Ireland is number four in the EU in terms of implementing remote and hybrid working strategies. You're behind the Netherlands, Sweden, and Luxembourg, apparently. So everyone is starting to think very differently. But I do think we have an opportunity here to think differently. And to be honest, I'm slightly depressed. I work primarily, my job is to innovate with and for our larger corporate business customers around the world and also public sector. So I get to work with a lot of sectors. I get to have a lot of conversations around the future of work. And nearly all of those conversations at the moment are about hybrid working. Now, I find this a tiny bit depressing, but it is a conversation that I am going to have with you initially. This is actually some research that we published, I think, about 4 months ago, a global piece of research where we asked IT leaders and global strategists around the world in multiple sectors, you know, what do you want to get out of work? How do you want to work? What are your challenges? And certainly in terms of work styles, what we are finding at the moment around the world, and we can see the impact of culture on some of this, but that 5-day working from the office and the 5-day working from home are not the norm anymore. It's actually something in between. And that something in between is ebbing and flowing as well. The stats I obviously do, I'm based in the UK, so I do tend to look at the UK stats a lot. And even in the past 6 months, we've seen the number of days that employees are coming into an office ebb and flow. February, oddly enough, was peak office. Now, you can understand that from the context. February was cold. February, energy prices were very, very high. Therefore, people were coming into the office to keep warm, to be perfectly honest. And we came into this kind of trend that we call value for commute. So if I'm going to commute into an office in maybe an urban location, there's got to be a value to it. And that's a big challenge in a hybrid situation, is to try and answer that question. What is the value of actually being in a place? Of course, in terms of offices, we are seeing some very distinctive trends. Typically, a lot of organizations are settling down into a 3-2 pattern, although, as I said, that's ebbing and flowing. The typical pattern are the Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdayers. I'm not going to abbreviate that one because it's slightly rude, and I believe I'm in polite company. But we have all sorts of patterns starting to emerge. For example, the potatoes, possibly on Tuesdays and Thursdays only. We have the Wednesdays plus oneers. So a lot of organizations are using anchor days to say, you know, most of us are going to be on this day and maybe one other day, but otherwise we're going to be working somewhere else. This is data from Stanford. And actually, if you are wanting to monitor the constant movement of data around work from home and remote working, Nicholas Bloom at Stanford is doing some incredible work. He's ex-Cambridge University. So he's been monitoring this. And you can see from the stats, and to be honest, we're seeing from our network stats, certainly in places like the City of London, that Fridays are tumbleweed. Basically, no one is in on a Friday anymore. Our mobile data in the City of London just falls through the floor, for example. And I'm doing quite a lot of work with the City of London at the moment because obviously that has a huge impact on their economy. But if you then look at the counter on that, actually rural economies, and Valencia would be a very good example of this, is probably benefiting. So actually people are maybe telecommuting, working from home in a lovely location like this, and spending their money on a Friday in particular in that rural location. So there are always winners and losers in this, but I suspect these patterns are going to continue. However, I will also say that I think this is completely the wrong conversation to be having. It should not be a conversation about how many days am I going to be in the office. And this is the point where I introduce my beloved Zidonk. Now, the Zidonk is my favorite hybrid. It is half zebra. It is half donkey. It looks a bit like a donkey with zebra socks, to be perfectly honest. It's very cute. Google it. But it does not wake up every morning going, oh my God, am I a zebra today? Or am I a donkey? Because it is a different breed. And actually, when we talk about hybrid work, this is a different way of working. It isn't about home. It isn't about an office. What we should really be asking is, how do we make the work work? And we need to do that for three reasons. And most of my research is concentrating on those three reasons. The first one, which is the one that I love because I am a psychologist, is how do we make work work for people? The evidence at the moment is that employee engagement is actually not as low as it was prior to the pandemic, but it is not very high. Gallup publish an engagement survey on a yearly basis. They just published their most recent one. I can tell you that currently in their engagement survey, the UK is sitting at around 10%. Ireland is at 11%. So you're not doing a lot much better than we are. The US, however, is about 32%. So you kind of have to think, well, there's a lot of hypotheses around why people aren't necessarily as engaged with their work as they should be. One of those reasons might be that they don't have a lot of choices over where and when they work. And I think the opportunity with hybrid is we can kind of untether ourselves from both place and time, potentially. And even those people, so the evidence is that 50% of people who are often knowledge workers could work from absolutely anywhere and at any time. There are, of course, 50% of workers who don't have those choices, who have to be physically co-located with their work. That doesn't mean you can't rethink their work. And certainly time is one thing that you can start to play with. So can you offer flexi hours, time bartering, payback schemes, where people can work a lot more flexibly than they can at the moment? I think the message is, actually, when we look at the roots of how we establish the ways that we work, actually, they were largely established during that period of incredible industrial change that included the laying of a transatlantic cable. That was the period of time where factories became the primary mode of working, where people actually went from running cottage industries, literally from home, to places where we went into centralized factories and centralized offices. And of course, we perfected scientific management as well, time and motion studies. We had things like clocking on and clocking off. Actually, the Monday to Friday week is a legacy of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of cultures actually worked 80, 90 hours a week. They didn't take a break. And of course, it was the factory schemes. Toyota introduced the Monday to Friday week because they recognized that maybe giving people 2 days off might make them more productive and engaged in their work. But of course, a lot of our productivity figures still now are measured on factory measures. The GDP is based on output per person. Now, I have to say, I'm a knowledge worker. I don't manufacture widgets. So today, I'm not sure if I've been productive or not. I've done email. I've done an interview. I've done a couple of calls. And now I'm talking to you. How do I measure my productivity in basically a measure that was derived during a factory age? So maybe we need to rethink productivity. And then, of course, the third one, and we've just heard, we have to look after the planet as well. We need to ask some very difficult questions around, is this the most carbon effective way of doing business? And certainly I once got on a plane to do a 1 hour meeting in Hong Kong. There is no way I would do that now. Firstly, it was stupid in the first place. But secondly, I have a lot of tools, those three C's, collaboration tools, connectivity in the cloud, enable me to do things in very different ways. This is why I love my job, because potentially at the moment, we have a lot of discussion and indeed we are having a lot of discussions on how do we reinvent work. And that could be anything from the 4-day work week through to the metaverse. So why are we doing this? Well, again, the research, crystal balls do not work. The research is kind of telling us that a lot of employers are primarily thinking about this because they cannot recruit the skills that they need. And obviously, as we've got a changing economic condition, that might change. But at the moment, the shoe is very much on the feet of the employee rather than the employer. And actually, if you ask employees what they want from a job, very basic psychology starts to kick in. They want purpose. They want flexibility. They want autonomy. They want trust. And actually, a lot of the hybrid ways of working give them that. And will a world recession potentially kind of change that conversation? Well, in the press at the moment, we are getting a lot of interesting discussions from the likes of Elon Musk, who was kind of, well, I want everyone back in the office. I'm not sure if that's, I mean, it might work for some, it might not work for others. We have to have a conversation beyond the office on this. But generally, most organizations want to recruit incredibly good people. And they probably want more flexibility. In fact, LinkedIn did some fabulous research showing that if jobs on LinkedIn were advertised as hybrid or flexible, they were 40% more likely to get applications. Sadly, their more recent research has shown that those jobs are on the decline in terms of advertising. But there are lots of other reasons. Obviously, yes, the climate and carbon challenges are in play. Rethinking the office, because that's definitely one thing that we're having questions about in a hybrid world. Why do we need an office? What are they for? I'm going to try and answer that question later. And then, of course, certainly the IT guys always come in and go, well, we can't work remotely or in a hybrid fashion because security. Now, I'm not going to go into the security question today. I'm not the expert. We have lots of those in BT. If you want to have a really long conversation about security, I can introduce you to a lot of people. But that's often used as an excuse not to do stuff. I'm an innovator. I'm kind of, well, okay, let's see how we can do it securely as well. Hybrid is not a new model. It's been around a long time. If you're in a global company, the chances are that you will be working somewhat in a hybrid way. But we know from a psychological perspective, there are some very interesting challenges from a cultural perspective. One of the primary ones is our cave brains tend to kick in on a lot of this. This is the anchor back into traditional ways of civilization, to be perfectly honest. So our cave ancestors used to get to know people by bumping into them. And they used to develop trust by developing strong ties between people. We had tribes for interestingly, now co-opted into the agile methodology, actually literally called tribes. So our cave brain is often dictating a lot of this. The difficulty in the hybrid world is, of course, we don't necessarily see people on a daily basis. So all of those traditional ways of forming relationships have kind of been a bit disrupted. One of the primary ones, of course, is, I mean, lots of discussions around, well, I have to be in an office because if I'm not seen to be there, am I going to get promoted? Am I going to get a good appraisal? So management is changing. And that's, I think, why a lot of very senior leaders and senior managers actually want people back in an office, because it makes their life easier. If you're leading by walking around is much, much harder when you're leading by zooming around. Obviously, other platforms are available, but that's a much, much harder discipline to do. Serendipity. Oh, I want people to bump into each other. So, okay, if that is your strategy, have you developed workplaces where people can bump into each other? That's why those little cubicles are not necessarily a good idea anymore. Probably the biggest one that we've probably all experienced is the, I call them horrible hybrids. The biggest one at the moment for me is hybrid meetings, and meetings generally, to be perfectly honest. So I don't know about you, but in lockdown, I did tend to wake up every morning with an impending sense of Zoom. Again, other platforms are available. But because we developed that frictionless way of working where we didn't have to travel, we didn't have to book rooms, we'd get up in the morning at 8 o'clock, we would log on. And at 6 o'clock, maybe we would log off, having done back-to-back 30 to 60 minute meetings. I don't know about you, but you know, that's tiring. In fact, there's a lot of psychology behind this again. If we look at cognitive peak, which is something I'm looking at the moment, our brains were not built to work 9 to 5. 9 to 5 was the factory way of working. 9 to 5 for a cognitive worker is very hard. In fact, Microsoft did some beautiful research where they literally wired people's brains up on those death by meeting days. And you could literally see what we all could tell you anyway, but you could see the brain starting to die mid-afternoon. We're even seeing at the moment some, again, Stanford's data showing that people are more likely to have their video cameras on in the morning than they are in the afternoon, because again, they're starting to get brain dead. So you'll get that vacant look. So okay, I'm going to turn my camera off. So the first thing to say is, one of the big things we probably need to think about when we transition from an analog world into a digital world is the meeting. The 4-day work week trials that we're seeing results from around the world at the moment are showing that if you want to move to a 4-day work week, the first thing you need to think about are the time vampires. Number one, a meeting. One of the few things I do agree with Elon Musk on, because I'm not a fan, I have to say, is if you've got a meeting that's got no agenda and no reason for you to be there, do not go. Just say, no, I'm not doing that meeting. So I have a current battle with my own boss on that one at the moment, because he keeps going, let's have a meeting. And I'm going, no, let's do this some other way. Then, of course, maybe we can think about things in a more digital way, a digital mindset on this. MIT, who we work, we actually have our own lab over at MIT in Boston. They've done some quite interesting work around ideation. So typically ideation, let's go and have a brainstorming session. So let's sit in a room with a lot of post-it notes. Brilliant. But is that the best way of doing things? We have asynchronous tools now. We don't have to come together all the time. So what they did as an experiment initially was to split brainstorming into an ideation session and then a discussion session. The ideation session was done out of time. So asynchronously, people could come up with ideas whenever or wherever they happen to be. And there was a study I put on my socials a couple of weeks ago showing where do you get your best ideas? Is it sitting in an office room with post-it notes, or is it going for a walk, particularly in this kind of environment, walking the dog, getting a breath of fresh air, having a shower? Showers are big for ideas. I'm not quite sure why, but you know, those kind of places are the places where we have the ideas. So actually, when they ran those asynchronous sessions, what they found was, firstly, they got more ideas, but they got better ideas. And then you can come together synchronously to start to discuss and prioritize those ideas. And the good thing then is you spend half the time doing it. So you've cut your time in half. Those time vampires are not quite so evident. So that's the first thing, rethinking the meeting itself. Then let's add hybrid. And we've all been on those meetings, I'm sure, where half the people are in the room, half the people are off in cyberspace. I was in a 4-hour physical meeting about 3 weeks ago, where we suddenly realized 2 minutes before the meeting ended that there were people online and we had no idea. Because again, if we think hybrid, we have to think digital. The mindset is not there are people in a room and there are people remote. The common ground is the digital platform. So what had happened was the people in the room, because of those cave brains, had started to get proximity biases activated. So we see the people. So we talk to the people. We ignore the people we can't see. The people we couldn't see were having a lovely conversation, actually, on chats, which obviously, because we were in the room, we were not on the chat session. So we were losing. We had two meetings, effectively. That cannot continue. And the technology, to be perfectly honest, is still catching up. So the traditional meeting room setup of having a camera at the end of the room, so the digital people have a tapering table in a small ant-like, well, I mean, there are ant-like people around that table. You have no idea who actually is in the room. You can't see them. And then it's shrunk to the size of a postage stamp in a lot of the video conferences as well. You've got no hope of figuring out who's in the room. And similarly, the people in the room, they can see you in little squares, but maybe that's not enough presence. And actually, if everyone is remote, one of the low-tech solutions is everyone just sits with their camera on. And that is weird if you were in the room. So there are lots of technologies starting to be evolved. There's the 360-degree camera that can use AI to pick out faces, sensitive microphone technologies that can zoom in on the person speaking, or indeed, the other day, the person eating crisps. So it's not fail-safe, but you know, I think that those kind of technologies are getting there, but there are other things that we can do. And maybe I'll give you a few clues at the end of the presentation. But ultimately, actually, the biggest skill for meetings, particularly hybrid ones, is the ability to moderate them. And to be honest, we don't teach leaders to do that very well, even in the physical space. And it's even more difficult in the digital space. So again, we need to think very differently around how do we do this stuff. And of course, the biggest conversation is around, well, why should I be in an office? This is a bit, I mean, the number of customers that I talk to that I've been having these conversations with, and indeed BT itself has been trying to tackle this big thing around why would I want to be in an office? Because we know, firstly, that during the pandemic, home working worked remarkably well, considering that most people were not volunteers. However, as we could see from that graph right early on, people don't necessarily want to work from home 5 days a week. They do want a little bit of variety. For the 50% that could work from home, 70% said it did work to a certain extent. 30%, however, struggled. That 30% tends to skew young, There are a number of reasons for that. Sadly, house prices at the moment mean that often younger employees are in shared accommodation or living with their parents, indeed. So they're competing for space, they're competing for bandwidth. Yes, we did have people working from ironing boards, certainly amongst our graduate population. So they don't necessarily have the right setup. But the other thing around the cave brain is often they haven't been in situations where they'd met people face to face. And again, the pandemic interrupted us on this as well. So they haven't built those strong ties that actually are much, much more reliable in terms of building those networks and relationships that we need to get on. In fact, probably one of the biggest skills for the future for anyone, not just leaders and not just managers, is the ability to network, not just in physical space, but also in digital space. And again, lots of conversations around, we know that people can build profound relationships in digital spaces. Hence, people meet on Twitter and get married, hopefully after meeting each other at some point. But you know, you can start to create connections. The beauty of those connections is they can be global. Again, back to the theme of the day. So we know that it doesn't, one size really does not fit all in terms of these strategies. Office spaces are evolving. Certainly BT strategy has been interesting, because if you look to the BT building of the past, it was very much rooted in our technologies. I could tell a BT building, they were the ones that basically had no windows because they were built for technologies, not people. I used to go into some of those buildings and have meetings, and I used to come out with a migraine because they were not built for people. Those buildings are now a thing of the past. Our buildings are shiny. They are built for people. They're glass. They are very much built for the things that we tend to do in an office, which typically are things like collaboration, communication, and a very important one that's often overlooked, building community. Those are what those spaces need to do. However, we also need to recognize that not everyone can work from home. They can't always work from a quiet space. So we need also places where there can be people working quietly. But this does not, I mean, the traditional way of doing offices was, how many people have I got? How many desks do I need? It's much more subtle now. A lot of the stuff that we're doing at the moment in the innovation space is to say, can we start to understand who's in the building? What are they doing? Do they have the right things, the right tools to do what they need to do? And because we do have those ebbs and flows, can we start to understanding the buildings better? So on a Friday, if there's only six people in, should we maybe close the office? Or maybe do we just create warm areas and cool areas if people do need to come in or have to come in for some reason, but we don't need to heat, light and cool the entire building. So again, with the planet in mind, can we start to do that? There is, however, something that had been growing before the pandemic but has been accelerated now, which is the third space to work, which is not the office and it's not home. Actually, the evidence is that home working isn't always as straightforward as it could be. 50% of home working days are from this third space, which I used to call the coffice, because anyone who knows me knows that I run on coffee. So as long as I have good coffee, I can work. So whether that's a hotel lobby, a coffee shop, I don't mind. Interestingly, I loved the Irish Rural Working Manifesto that was published a couple of years back, because I thought the thinking on that was brilliant, because they were looking at, well, if you're looking at a community, and that's what those physical spaces are doing, what's the hub of the community? And obviously, the obvious answer is the pub. So poffices, I like to call these. In fact, interestingly enough, my local just round the corner has been following the Irish lead on this and has been advertising for, I think it's about £10 a day. You get unlimited tea and coffee, you get free Wi-Fi, and then you get a gin at the end of the day, or a beer, because you probably need it, to be perfectly honest. So we can start to rethink our workspaces. But I think, again, from a climate perspective, that's quite attractive. So rather than having that 2-hour commute, we can start to look at greener commutes, cycling, walking into work, actually creating a much more vibrant local community where we live, as well as maybe sometimes going into the office when it matters. But giving people choices, that flexibility, is absolutely key. There is a downside to this, though. I used to call this trend the death of Dolly, because frankly, firstly, I'm a huge Dolly Parton fan. She's not dead, by the way, at least I haven't checked Twitter yet, but she is most definitely alive and kicking. But of course, that lovely song from 9 to 5, Well, that's been broken for a while. And I keep saying that was broken again by technology. So actually, this was nothing to do with being in an office or not being in an office initially. It's because those lovely little devices that are always on and always on us basically tether us back wherever we happen to be. This got exacerbated due by the pandemic. Certainly some of the interviews we did with people who were working from home, maybe not by choice, came across as we feel as if we're living at work now. The problem, of course, as Kevin Kelly quite rightly points out, it's not about connection anymore. Actually, it's about disconnection. When do I turn off? Because those boundaries have gone. The 9 to 5, the Monday to Friday, might not exist in our minds. And a problem, of course, with being constantly connected is you can work longer and longer hours. However, we are human. Longer hours certainly does not equal better productivity. In fact, longer hours has a very tragic consequence in terms of burnout. And we're actually seeing that a lot in China at the moment, hence lots of talk in China around things like the lie flat movement. I think we need to really think about this. The research that we've been doing certainly has been linked into this trend that we call techno-stress. So working with Lancaster University and Cambridge University, we've identified a number of things that we need to think about around our technologies. You can see mostly the Lancaster research here. So our technologies encourage us to multitask. Multitasking is terrible for productivity. And again, our brains are not built to multitask. So actually, we find that interruptions are causing us to become less productive. It's like our brain trying to juggle 8 hours a day. If I physically juggled for 8 hours a day, I would fall over. We're trying to get our brains to do this. It's not the right way of doing it. Hence, we need to maybe rethink the ways that we work. One of the other big ones is that ability to disconnect, the always on mentality. And this is where we've done a lot of work with Cambridge University. We built with Cambridge a diet, which we were going to call the Cambridge diet, but someone got there before us. So we've had to call it the Balanced Communication Diet for Business, but it is a 5-step plan to better communication. And to be honest, for those who are stressed by their technology and are finding it difficult to turn off, there are 3 main reasons. The M and M and M's: meetings, managers, and messages. Those are the 3 stressors that often cause us to work longer and longer and longer. And actually, if you are interested, that diet is published because it gives you some very practical hints and tips as to what you can potentially do about it. But I would get my innovation credentials revoked if I didn't, by the end of the lecture, mention 2 of the trendy technology topics of the time. One, of course, being the metaverse and the other one being AI. So the metaverse, let's try and tackle this one for a start. Do I want to work from the metaverse? Probably not, to be perfectly honest. I don't want to be in the Matrix, and I don't really want to be in Ready Player One. And to be honest, that ultimate vision of the metaverse is science fiction at the moment. What we are doing is not really the metaverse. It is the baby steps towards it. So whether that's virtual reality, augmented reality, or mixed reality, that is the kind of thing that we're looking at. Now, virtual reality, I'm not a fan of. I call it vomity reality. It's mainly because if you put a headset on me, and it still happens over the years, people keep going, it'll get better, but generally you need a bucket. Also, I have discovered that drinking coffee with a VR headset on is very difficult. So again, another negative for me. Don't get me wrong, I think virtual reality has a very big place in things like training and simulation, but do I want to sit in it 7 hours a day? Possibly not. So I'm going to concentrate mostly on the stuff that we're doing with augmented and mixed reality. I'm just going to pick a few exciting examples out. The coolest, to be perfectly honest, is stuff that we're doing with the NHS in the UK around the 5G ambulance, we call it, but it's a paramedic with an augmented reality headset on. You can see him in the center there, and a haptic glove. So using 5G, what we're doing is broadcasting live, high-definition visuals back to a remote clinician who is literally seeing through the paramedic's eyes. That clinician, this is the fun bit, has a little joystick. And that joystick is driving that haptic glove. Someone got nightmares after this one the other day, so I apologize if this gives you nightmares. But basically, what it does is nudge the paramedic to make sure that their hand is in the right place to do a procedure that they would not be able to do unsupervised. So the idea there is to reduce hospital admissions. We're trialing that at the moment. This is blurring back and front office, by the way. So those frontline workers and the people that are more classic knowledge workers start to work more closely together. In terms of those frontline workers, the guy in the orange there is actually in Belfast Harbour. We are working a lot in Northern Ireland and particularly in the harbour there at the moment, again, using 5G. He's a crane inspector, so we can't give him handheld technologies. He's got an augmented reality headset on, just a little checklist in front of his eyes. He can bring in a remote opinion if he wants. So there's a camera on there if he's not sure about something. We're also tethering a drone to that solution as well. So he doesn't have to climb the crane quite as much, which has got huge implications for things like health and safety. And then mixed reality, we're doing some very cool stuff. Initially in the classroom, this is no glasses required for this. So this is a 360 degree or 180 degree, depending on what you want, projection system that turns an entire room into an interactive space. The initial thing we did was to immerse kids at the bottom of the ocean. They could actually physically come and have a look at the transatlantic cable and find out all about the history of it without actually having to scuba dive by immersing them into that classroom. I went into that and went, oh, could we use this for meetings? So actually what we're trialing at the moment is an augmented, a mixed reality solution where those remote people are beamed in full size. So again, it's very difficult to ignore them if you're in the room at that point. So we'll see how that one goes. Then, of course, I'm a massive Star Wars fan, so I'm very excited to be very in very close proximity to where the Porgs lived. But I'm also very excited about the possibility of holograms, because I've my lifetime ambition at the moment is to not be standing here, although I've missed Valencia, to be honest. But if I was standing in my front room, being beamed to you as a 3D hologram, I would have Danish pastries on my ears, and I would be saying, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. This is actually the next generation of video. It's called volumetric video. It's something we're working on at the moment. It's not the same as avatars, which are being talked about an awful lot. ABBA had to wear Lycra and dots in order to get very expensive motion capture. If you want to wear Lycra and dots, I'm not going to stop you, but this uses multiple cameras to basically either capture in real time, again, using 5G, we can either squirt a real time image of you into a metaverse if that's where you want to be. But also at the moment, we have these incredible holographic booths in both our Adastral Park showcase, but also in our London showcases that will, it's uncanny what we can do in those. Very expensive to do at the moment, but the cost will come down. And then finally, AI. I had to mention it because the metaverse is kind of on the wane in terms of hype. AI is completely stratospheric at the moment. And that's largely because of the generative AI and also the media going, Armageddon, we're going to lose all our jobs. It's going to replace every human being on Earth. Now, Microsoft just did some fabulous research showing that that's not the intention of most employers. They are not going to replace everybody by AI. Their main ambition at the moment is looking at productivity, which again, I think these tools could make us a lot more productive. Case in point, I was too lazy to do this slide. So I got ChatGPT to do it. I asked it, how is AI going to impact the future world of work? And it came up with a pretty good thing. I was making coffee, by the way, whilst it did this. So I came back with my full cup of coffee. It had generated everything I needed to cut and paste into a slide. It's reasonably good. However, it's not. It's still pretty thick, to be perfectly honest. The one to trick it at the moment is to say, ask it how many, what's the third letter of, what's the third word in any sentence you care to choose. It will probably get it wrong because it has no concept of what the sentence is. It has no concept of a word. All it's doing is figuring out algorithmically what is likely to be the next word in this sentence. So it has not got even remotely human level intelligence. And that's where I think the next real challenge for work is coming in. It's not about replacing humans. It's about augmenting them. And actually, if Albert Einstein was alive, I'm sure he'd be very excited. But that's allegedly what he said around automation and humans. It doesn't necessarily replace us. Sure, some tasks are going to be completely automated out and have. In the history of automation, there are a lot of tasks that have been automated out already. That means that actually, I mean, technology is good at doing certain things, following rules, following processes. It needs data. We're actually pretty good at doing things that are very creative and complex and anarchic. Empathy, caring, all of those things we are very good at doing. They are very complex and by their nature, very difficult to measure. So again, back to those productivity measures. But I like to take heart in terms of there are a lot of opportunities here to change the ways that we train people, change our productivity. And I take a lot of these lessons from the world of chess. I've been working with a few chess players recently, and I had the absolute privilege of meeting Garry Kasparov a few years ago, who, of course, got beaten by AI. Now, he could have just given up chess. He didn't. He invented augmented chess. So basically, AI and a human play another AI and human. That makes the game much, much more interesting. But actually, in the world of chess now, the grandmasters do not play each other to train. They play AI. And that makes them a much better player. And that's, I think, where we're... Well, I'm an optimist, by the way. So I'm hoping that we can actually use AI to help us as humans, to make us more human, actually, in terms of the workplace. Of course, there is a risk that it might go the other way, but I really do hope there are lots of opportunities here to rethink work for the good of people, for productivity and the planet. Now, if you're interested in any of this data, to be honest, if you're having trouble sleeping, can probably help. There's a ton of data under this. Please do ping me. I'm on socials. You know, just contact me at any point. I'm sure I can share you some good bedtime reading. Meanwhile, thank you very much for coming along, and thank you for listening.
Extremely enthusiastic as ever. Nicola Miller there from the Valencia Transatlantic Cable Foundation Lecture 2023. And we will have more from that series of lectures and some snippets of interviews I took while I was down in Kerry during the summer. And we'll have that on our next episode of the STEM Inspirations podcast. But in the meantime, if you are of secondary school age, don't forget entries for the 2024 BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition are closing soon, so make sure you have your entries in. And also, if you have anybody that is in primary school, well, why don't you get them interested in our primary schools competition, which is open for entries too. You'll find all the details on the website btyoungscientist.com. So from me, John Loftus, till the next STEM Inspirations podcast, mind yourselves out there, and remember, stay curious.